The Guardian.
It's AC Jimbo, dear listener, with the second in our series of Barry Glendinning's interviews with footballers from back in the day. On a windy Wednesday back in February, Barry travelled to a freezing Etihad Stadium to meet up with Sean Gota to find out more about the GOAT's amazing life story, from growing up in Bermuda to being taken on and then discarded by Man United to then establishing himself as the cultist of all cult heroes at Manchester City.
OK, Sean, nice to meet you. The first thing people are going to want to know is, how does a kid from Bermuda end up making it as a Premier League striker in England? You know, you seem to have had quite an idyllic childhood in Bermuda, is that fair to say?
Yes.
Tight family unit.
Yes, growing up Bermuda was obviously beautiful. It, you know, the lifestyle and everything was wonderful. But, you know, for Bermuda kids, or kids in the Caribbean in particular, you know, you always wanted to have, you're having this dream of wanting to play in England in the big leagues, and I was no different. And for me, fortunate was Man United actually came to Bermuda on a mid-season break. And with them coming over, it allowed them to see me in a game. In Bermuda, we have what you call a doubleheader. It was two games. I was playing in the opening game. The main game was United playing against the national team in the second game, but they had seen me play. Offered me trials. Lo and behold, I was successful with the trials and was at United for 2 years as a YT. So, yeah, beautiful time.
What age were you when you came over for the trial?
I was 18 up to 20 when I then moved on to Rotherham United. I was delighted because, you know, I was a kid that was able to reach his dreams by playing professional, and then that's really the real journey and the hard work started.
Now, when you went Manchester United, you did the trial and like you left behind your family, your girlfriend at the time, now your wife. It must have been tough.
Yes, it was. So you've done your research as well. Yes, it was. I mean, my wife, we were boyfriend and girlfriend in school. So at the same time, when Christmas came around, or any sort of holidays, I didn't really want to be communicating with her because, you know, whenever I got on the phone and they'll say, oh, yeah, you know, your aunt is here, your uncle's here, your cousin, your nana, your nephew, everybody was at the house. And so that used to make me feel even more homesick. So when Christmas or any sort of holidays came around, I did not want to be calling her. I'd do it either before, a few days before, or a few days after.
And when you did the trial, you didn't hear back from United for a pretty long time after that. Did you think that the opportunity had passed?
Well, yes, and I realised that I come to find out that you needed to have played 12 international games. At the time, I had played 11. And so what we got was the Premier in Bermuda had got in touch with the big leagues over this side and made it happen because I was that close to having the 12 games, so it was made to be, and so I was pleased that came about. But yes, it was the best part of 4 to 5 months in between whether I was going to come over or not.
And when you did eventually become a United player, it was quite early in Sir Alex Ferguson's reign. He'd just started, I think. And the first thing you did was asking for a pay rise. How did that go for you?
You have done your research.
It seems like a very brave move.
Well, it was an easy thing to ask for because in coming from an amateur background and not knowing the protocol that you have in the game. But I was actually earning more money in Bermuda Bermuda is a high standard of living. So I was actually earning more money doing summer jobs than I was as a YT player at United. And I just thought, is this what they get paid? Surely it can be. So I conjured up enough guts, if you like, to go and ask. I said, well, you know, I'm paying for a mortgage and this is less than what I actually get. And so Sir Alex Ferguson had gave me an increase. It was a big increase £40.
Oof, massive. And at this time now, you were sort of palling around with Lee Sharp, which also could have been dangerous. did he lead you astray at all in any way? He had quite the reputation as a bit of a party boy.
Well, this was, again, we were all young, and at this time, Lee was also in digs, and we were in the same dig, so along with three others. So our digs, we had quite a few lads there. But on the weekends, I would typically go to Lee's house and his family, his mother, Gail, and his father, Leo. So they were very welcoming. So every now and again, when all the kids would actually go off to home, I would go back to Lee's. But in the early days, it was nothing. You weren't thinking about parties or anything like that, because it was about trying to get in the first team. And Lee got into the first team, so he was ever so disciplined. I wanted to stay there and knew the expectation and what was expected of him. So he was very disciplined in his ways. And I think you're probably talking more about later in his years. This was way after I had left United. But, yeah, he was very disciplined, certainly in his early years.
And at what point did it become sort of apparent to you that you weren't going to get into the United first team?
When I sat in his office and he said, "Someone wants you, and you're not going to get in my team."
All right, fair enough.
But I needed that, and at that time I didn't think so. You're a kid and you think you know it all. You think you're better than what you are, and the reality was I did need to move down to a level or two to get my more understanding of the game. So it was the right move for me to move on. I was at Rotherham for 6 years, and probably longer than I would have wanted or was expected. But it was the right thing for me to really adjust to the English game.
Would it be fair to say you didn't enjoy your early years at Rotherham, the training regime? I saw there's a quote from your book. The theory at Rotherham was that we weren't good enough to keep the ball, so we had to be fit enough to win it back.
And that was the philosophy probably amongst a lot of managers at that time and era. And that was, you're not good enough to keep it, so we're going to be fit enough to win it back. And so it was almost twice a week you were doing these grueling physical sessions. And, you know, we're already sports sciences then. At that time, and when we needed them, because, yeah, we done a hell of a lot of physical work. And I remember every Monday we'd have a grueling session where players would be bringing up. And I look at players today and I just think, you get nowhere near that because, you know, they've got all the heart rate monitors and it's all done on their workload to make sure that they're not overworking themselves so that they're ready for the game, which is the right way.
Yeah. It does seem extraordinarily antiquated way of going about things. Like, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't even share the stories because it is so antiquated. But that's what managers knew, and that's what, you know, that's what players did, because that's what were asked of them, and you got on with it. And that was the testing time of how much I really wanted to be a professional player, was really asking me that question, because, you know, again, life was kind of good in Bermuda, but it didn't offer professional football. And I was, how much do you really want this? To know every Monday and not knowing how long that I have to go do these running sessions and be bringing up your guts. And it sort of makes you think, like, is this what it's about for the rest of my career of playing? But I stuck with it, and, you know, it changed. You got to different teams. And I still had some good years at Rotherham because, you know, some managers changed and we looked to play. But that's also thankful to the fans, and they were also sort of demanding, which prepared me for my later years as well.
And while you were at Rotherham, were your the people back home in Bermuda aware, like, would they be following your progress, following your career?
Yeah, so there were no such thing as Twitter and Facebook and all of those things. But funny enough, my good friend, eventually became my agent. Well, he was working in Bermuda, and what we typically did was we used to get the games recorded and have them aired back in Bermuda, so Bermuda public can actually see them.
Oh, okay.
So Bermudians, they will be delayed, so they will be looking at last week's game, but it was a way in that Bermudians were able to see what I was doing. So they were current, but not as current as knowing how I performed perhaps this weekend, or, you know, as much as last week is what it was about.
So does this mean there's kind of a load of middle-aged men wandering around Bermuda who support Rotherham? You know, is that their team? Or?
Yeah, there'll be a fan base there. There'll be a fan base from...
Oh, bizarre. you weren't particularly prolific goal scorer at those times. You know, you weren't getting 20-plus a season. So what changed and when...
Well, certainly in my first three seasons at Rotherham, again, I wasn't prolific. And if I'm honest, I think it was adjusting to the whole culture. The lifestyle, it was, in terms of England, the weather, the physicality of the game, the pace of the game. It was really adjusting. And this was going into my fifth year of being in England. It really did take me that long to adjust. But my last 3 years at Rotherham, I was always scoring 20... around 24 to 26 goals in my last 3 years at Rotherham. And that's when I became consistent in scoring. The early years at Rotherham were very difficult and challenging because, again, at United, you were asked to play. If a player was on you, you know, the ball was still given to you. At Rotherham, if there's a player near you, you wouldn't dare see the ball. The coach would be saying, well, what you doing giving it to him? There's a man on him. So that the adjustment to that was hard. Along with other parts of, again, the weather. I used to find it very difficult with the cold. Fingers and feet, could not feel my feet were playing. So if you talk about, you know, something as simple as chip a delicate ball, I can't feel my feet. And footballers is all about the feel when you connect with a ball. And, you know, playing, and you can't feel if you're going to do a delicate chip or a particular technique of shooting. My feet felt like blocks of ice.
And you had your first Wembley experience with Rotherham, is that right? You won, and then there was a downer on the way home. You fell out with Archie Gemmill, the manager, or joint manager. And that was the end of your time there, wasn't it?
Well, yes, that signal, because the last three seasons, I was the top goal scorer, and I was coming to the end of my contract, looking at the potential of an extended contract with an increase, but all was on offer was same terms, but addition, meaning another year or two, but the same money. So I was thinking, well, I'm in the top two goal scorers in the league. How are you offering me the same term? So that along with the experience of going home, I think it was a total miscommunication in what had taken place. It was another point of me growing up in that it was a situation that happened. I'm sure you know because you would have done your research, but it was a situation where a car had gone across and the lads were making a bit of noise in regards to the ladies who were driving the car. Show us here, you know what? And he had come up the back of the coach thinking it was me that had said it, or pointed out just me. And I said, well, it wasn't me that was saying that. So with that, when we got back, I felt it was a need for me to address it. And it was a real dampener on the whole way home because we had won. Yeah. We had won the trophy. But I basically saw him after and I said, well, you know, one, you've totally got it wrong. And two, I need you to apologize to me in front of the team because I think it was totally wrong of what you were saying. So with that, the very next morning, we were all in. He got us all set down, and he had apologized to me. And so that was a growing point because I think it was somewhere around 24. So it was a growing point that I could react in a whole different way and had to go back at him and been sacked. Yeah. for what I had said and done. But I think I handled it in a mature way and asked him to apologize and he done the right thing by apologizing, and since then it's, you know, we've moved on, seeing him and, you know, speak and say hello, and that's it. For me, it was just forgotten at that point.
So you go to Bristol City then, and you're replacing Andy Cole, basically. Big boots to fill. Were you aware of the pressure, or...?
Well, whenever you... No, not at all. Whenever you because it was a level that I was familiar with. And, you know, I was scoring 24 to 26 goals in the last three seasons. So, and then seeing the chairman at the time, Scott Davison, he had said to me, he had spoken to several fans and he had asked them to write a list. It was about 10, 15 fans and said, who is your most wanted sort of forwards that you like? And my name came up on Olam's list as number one. So I knew that the fans were wanting me, and he pursued it to make it happen. So I knew that, you know, the fans were wanting me, and two, he wanted me as the chairman. And when you go somewhere, you know, when you know that your fans want you and the chairman wants you, you're more than happy to oblige and provide them with, you know, give them that return. But yes, Andy Cole was there, and we know how prolific a player he was. But I just went in to perform and do exactly what I've done previously. And in the two seasons there, I was the top goal scorer and left on the transfer deadline to Man City. So a beautiful time at Bristol City, really enjoyable.
At this stage, you're sort of mid-20s, you've spent your career in the bottom two divisions. Were you happy with the way things were going, or frustrated that you weren't getting a chance at a bigger club or a higher level, or what was your feeling at the time?
Yeah, I was frustrated within myself. I was thinking, why is this opportunity not coming? When, you know, for consecutive seasons, two, three seasons, I'm in the top two goal scorers in my division. But players who are scoring less than me were moving and going to Premiership teams at the time. And so that was sort of like, what is it I'm doing, or what is it I'm not doing? To help me get that move. And it was at that point I just said, well, you know what, if it's going to be, it will be, just let it go, just enjoy your football. And I went down with a clear sort of thought process at Bristol, just go and enjoy your football, and if this is where you're going to be, then this is where you're going to be, but enjoy being at this level. Yeah. And then it happened into my second season at Bristol City.
And why do you think you weren't getting the opportunity? I think your agent and mate at the time, he wasn't particularly well connected, was he, in football, or am I wrong?
No, you're correct. He wasn't an agent as in around the football football scene. But in terms of why not getting that opportunity, I don't know. I think it's, I'm a believer that, you know, if you score goals and you're a regular, consistent goal scorer at League Two, I feel that player, given the opportunity, will score goals in League One, and because all you need is time to adjust. And the same will happen in the Championship. Once you have time to adjust to the league, because a goal scorer is a goal scorer. They know how to find the goal. They know where to be, depending on the type of goal scorer they are. And they just need their time to settle in and adjust to the league, the level, the players that they're playing with. Who are the players that can provide them with those opportunities and the demands in those leagues? And I think, sometimes it's a lot of players you can see. You see scoring goals and you think, well, that player there can play at a higher level. But it's about who can be brave as a manager that would say, well, I see he scores goals maybe two levels below, you know, where I am as a manager. It may be even a Championship manager that says, well, I don't know. It's League Two. A goal scorer for me is a goal scorer, and I think with time, he can be a goal scorer in the Championship and so forth with the Premiership as well.
When you went to City, they were basically in a tailspin, heading towards Armageddon. How quickly did it come for you to realise that this may not have been a very wise move?
Well, I always believed in myself it was the right move, but I got a quick reminder that perhaps it wasn't the right move. Because again, I was playing with Bristol City, and Bristol City was doing well to get promoted. And so the team was full of confidence and playing well, and you know, we were sort of dominating games. And then I came to City where the confidence was low, fans were booing players.
At the training ground as well, I believe.
At the training ground. And my wife came and she just watched like two games and she just went, this team's rubbish. and I said to her, this is definitely the right move. But what she saw was a team that lacked confidence. lacked belief because fans were getting on the players' backs, and so therefore players were playing well within themselves. And in my first, I mean, I came in a deadline, so I had seven games. It was seven games to sort of revive and try to avoid relegation.
And just City were in the second division at this stage, heading towards the third. Basically.
Correct, yeah. And so it was a case of, trying to avoid that drop. And, we have fans coming to the training ground, and they would sit, park the car, have their lunch and shout, "You're rubbish, you're useless." And it was just, but, you know, Will Donaghy, Juro at the time, I think they were brilliant because they realized he had to make some changes, and they did. And I don't mean necessarily with players. Such things as we would be getting booed in warm up. So we used to get in a little minibus, and we used to drive to a school 2 minutes away, and we used to warm up in the school gym. It's amazing.
Before a game,
and then we'd come out, and you put your boots on, and you had to get your footwear right when you came out, because you really only had 2-3 minutes to adjust to the pitch, and then you start the game.
You kind of have to admire someone who will go so far as to like drive to the training ground at lunchtime just to go to the trouble of booing a team. It's a kind of, well, they're obviously a bit bonkers, but, you know, that is dedication, isn't it?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, we represent, you know, their hometown, their team, their manner. And if we're not performing and producing, this is what we get. And this is how fans feel, and they want to show that. And they have that capability to be able to stand nearby, have a bit of lunch, and say, you know, we're useless. And, you know, I could only assume they were our fans because they were booing us when we warmed up. But in saying that, they could have well have been United fans. But in saying that, again, it built a layer of thickness, you know, going through that time, going through that period. You know, all the players had gone through that. And allowed us to come out, I think, certainly as stronger players, really experiencing the dark side of the game. But also knowing that with hard work, there's another side to the game, and some of us were able to achieve that.
So City, this massive club, find themselves in the third tier of English football, and then you're part of the team that lost, I'm sorry to remind you, the famous game against Mansfield in the Otto Windscreens Trophy at home, which is basically a club nadir. Manchester City hit rock bottom there. What was confidence like at that point? And I presume like you were the biggest scalp in the division, so every team was really trying it really hard against you.
Yes, every team. I mean, you mentioned there about Mansfield, and I also remember, you know, playing against Lincoln. Yeah, we did play against Lincoln. And we lost at Lincoln, and I remember their fans ran on the field. You thought it was to win the FA Cup. How they ran on the field, and that's when it dawned on me that every team we play, it's the biggest game for them. And so again, losing to Mansfield was another one of those games that, you know, who would have thought of, you know, Mansfield beating Man City? But we were low in confidence. There was no real belief within the players. There was always hard work, but the belief within our own selves and our abilities just wasn't there.
Yeah. And then that year, the famous playoff final against Gillingham. Gillingham were 2-0 up, 8 minutes left.
Yeah, it's amazing because you're sitting, as the game is going on, there was this brief period. We're sitting after they scored the second goal. And for me, that brief period was after they've scored and we're walking back to centre, all this hard work we put in this season is going to waste. And so that negative thought is coming to my mind at that particular time. And I had been doing sports psychology. And so I knew with that, I had to use my tools to stop myself from thinking that. So I immediately went into sort of positive stuff. And we got on with the game. And Kevin Horlock had scored probably about a minute after we sent it off or so. And at that time, it was like, come on, the injury, the sorry, the the time went up for injury time of another 4 minutes, 5 minutes, I believe it was. And from there, it seemed like that's more than enough time to get an equalizer. And the crowd gave this great big roar. It's almost like they came onto the field and they sort of like ushered everybody, like, we're going to suck this ball into the goal. But the belief became more and more. And, you know, it was a ball that was given through to me. I believe it was from Kevin Orlock. And I've gone to shoot. And the defenders put a great challenge on. And it's deflected to Paul. To this day, I tell Paul I was passing it to him. Deflected to Paul Dickoff, and he hits it. And as he hits it, the oncoming defender it just deflects off him. And with that, it just takes it over the goalkeeper. And when that ball goes in, I'm just thinking, you little beauty. Like, I love you. So we scored the equalizer. And at that point, we're just thinking, okay, let's get to the end of this because we're going to extra time. Once we get into extra time, as no one could have told me it would have went to penalties, I would have said, we will win this game within the extra time. We were strong throughout. They managed, you know, credit to them, they managed to hold on because we had such belief at that time. And then it went to penalties. And I was the fifth penalty taker. And I think Reeves knew, so Reeves said, I got to pull off a couple saves. So he heard the order, the penalty. So, Nicky Weaver pulled off the penalty, and it was brilliant.
I mean, there's been some great playoff finals, but that's one of the classics, isn't it? You know, was it a career highlight for you, or just an absolute, you know, relief?
Because of our journey at City, it's a few highlights. You know, obviously Blackburn. Beating Blackburn to go back to the Premiership. But that game also is a highlight because, again, that was the first time getting to the Premiership. And so it was huge. It was a huge, huge, huge game for us.
In your autobiography, you say it took a while for the City fans to kind of warm to you. And you ended up having to, like, copy some of Paul Dickoff's tricks of running around industriously to get them out, even though you were scoring lots of goals. But when did you first become aware of the famous feed the goat chant?
I think we were playing against maybe in Fulham at home, and it was only then a couple times people were saying, yeah, you heard a song about you, the song. And I'm like, because again, I was doing sports psychology, and part of my thing was, you know, I had the saying of no crowd, there's no cheers, there's no booze. So basically, if I done something good, I didn't hear them. If I done something bad, I didn't hear them. So I was sort of in this game zone because you had to get in a state of blocking the crowd out, because again, you have to remember the amount of booze that you'll get, it could affect your whole game.
Yeah.
So I think it may have been a Fulham game, and I end up scoring a hat-trick, and I clearly heard them, and I was thinking, oh, they're singing about me. Singing about me. Oh, right, feed the goats. Oh, yeah, I'm having that. And I think that was the time. And I thought, well, Sean, you know, for me, in my own sort of space and time set off by myself, it was like, you've come some way, because now they're singing about you. They're singing about you, so you must be doing something right. And at the same time, it was like, but don't get carried away, mate, because, you know, you've come a long way. You've got to keep doing what you're doing.
After 11 years, you stepped out for your first Premier League game. How did that feel? Was it like, I have arrived, I am a proper professional footballer, or did you just take in your stride?
Well, you want to. You want to be all calm about it. You know, yeah, I've been here before, but there's a lot of nerves, a lot of nerves before the game. There's nerves as you're walking on the pitch, but the nerves go once the game starts, you know, because that's your normality, that's where you belong. That's what you do. So that's where the calmness starts to settle in when the game, the whistle goes and the game is kicked off. But yeah, prior to the game, there's nerves because you know, it's something you dreamt of. I dreamt of in Bermuda saying, yeah, I would like to play at the highest level. And that was the day of achieving that.
So your season prem, City went down again, and Joe Royle was handed his P45, and Kevin Keegan came in. Would it be fair to say you're not Kevin Keegan's biggest fan?
I didn't think that when he came, I was delighted because I was sitting there thinking, one, top striker for England, respected coach, manager, also had managed England. So for me, it was like my stock was rising to be managed under a manager like this.
Yeah.
So I was truly excited about it, to think, what is it that I can learn from Kevin Keegan as a top striker and as a top manager?
Well, he worked more on defence than attack, which seems strange, but...
I wouldn't say he worked more on defence. Well, Keegan was an open...
from the front, if you know.
He was an open... He was about, you know, we score five and they'll score three, so we'll win the game. So his philosophy was everyone on the field should want the ball, and something that I believe in. So he wanted all his players to want the ball, to play out from the back and to create opportunities. I came to find out that, so as time went on, he was looking at perhaps trying to offload me, but I was the top goal scorer, so it was the fans, I suppose, that was making noise, I guess, to board members, yeah. Or board members saying, well, he's our top goal scorer, you know, why are we letting him go until we perhaps get ourselves where we need to be, and then look at that. So there was, I suppose, some pressure outside of me, you know, me scoring goals, and fans and board members that were saying, no, perhaps we need to keep Sean.
And so... So you got back to the Premier League, and then there was sort of the last season at Main Road. You captained the side for the last home game. You scored twice in the final derby against Manchester United at Main Road. It must have been a special year for you, was it? Or were you a bit fed up that things weren't going so well with Mr. Keegan?
Yeah, it was bittersweet because, again, you talk about highlights is... You know, being the captain of the team in the last ever game at Main Road, you know, that was an emotional day because it meant a lot for me to be captain, and it for me it showed just how far I've come in terms of to be seen as to be the captain with my journey and how the fans initially were. So that was quite emotional and enjoyable. I was proud of that, but at the same time I also knew that I was on my way out, and not through me wanting to go out, but because I knew no matter what I was capable of achieving or doing, I was never going to be in the team because of how I done, because the manager had other plans.
Matt, you had a very successful career and you did well with City, but City have had better players than you. They have better players than you now, and yet you're held in the highest of regard by the fans. What? Why do you think that is? I mean, that you're probably among the most loved City players in history.
It's a mixture of things, and it's a mixture of things. One, I think it's my journey with the fans, and when I came, I initially wasn't loved or liked as a player, but I won that battle, and they come to see and understand me as a player. I think I never changed in the person that I was, in that I always had time to give an autograph and have a photo and have a chat. And I think, you know, even though getting stick and all of those sort of things, if fans will look at it from the peripheral and say, do you know what, we've just been hammering today, and look at him, he's still signing an autograph, he's still smiling for a photo, and that hasn't changed. And I think it's those things there that the fans look at and say, well, he's produced it on the field and off the field. You know, he's humble and he's approachable and easy as pie. So he's number one for me. I think those are the reasons why they hold me in such esteem.
And the City you joined couldn't be more different from the City we see here today. What do you make of all that? The money that's been pumped in, as a fan. Obviously, the success must please you. Do you think, though, maybe it's lost a bit of its soul, the club?
Well, it can't, because I'm battling. I mean, currently I'm battling with this thing of, you know, who do you support? You got City First Team, you got the City Ladies Team, you got City in New York, and it's almost like you can... you know, normally you have one team you support and you give everything for that one team. And so I'm sat at home thinking, like, how far can you stretch your support? How far can you, you know, stretch their support? So I think it's great. I think it's great, you know, because we'd have never seen in, certainly in my time or earlier years to me playing, that City will be where it is and have the top world-class players that it has. I'd like to hope and think that with having these top world-class players, that we get the balance right of the kids that come through, get an opportunity. Because that's the part there that I think that we shouldn't miss. And that, I suppose, you know, it needs to be made noise about, because it's all right buying the top world-class players. But I haven't spent a lot of time looking at some of the academy players, and some of them are of decent quality. And if they're not really going to get a chance, it makes you think, well, what is the academy for? Yeah. And, you know, and I look at the City fans. I know that they would love to have one or two players that are from around these parts. And there is young kids in the academy, but I don't know will they ever get in the first team. And that's the downside to all the success that the club is having. But, you know, I'm probably talking out both sides of my mouth with her, you know, by saying that this is great that we have Aguero and Yaya and David Silva and company and these top world-class players. And I'm always like, yes, more of it, because I sit and do commentary and watch these teams, you know, watch the games and watch these teams come here and think, they can't live with us. This is so great to watch. It's so great to see this high level of football. But then I go around the academy and I watch them. I think, this is really good. This is good quality. And then I go, well, he's played one game, you know, or this kid is just not in around the squad. And that's another side to it. So I don't know. I mean, that people get paid big bucks to make those decisions and balance that stuff. That's not me. But it'll be good to see the one or two young players get opportunities and sustain opportunities. But that's the conundrum that, you know, City find itself in, but it's not a bad one to be in.
How would Sean Goldsworth in his pomp have got on in a team up front with Aguero and Silva and Yaya Toure playing through the middle? Do you think he'd have done okay?
Yeah, easily. And I'm not an arrogant person. I say that because in the City team, what you do know is you will get a chance as a forward. And forwards being forwards, somewhere along the line, put them away. And that's the great thing about playing for City, in that, you know, if you've got David Silva and Yaya Toure, you know, Fernandinho and Neves and Milner and these sort of players, you're going to get opportunities. And my best spell, or certainly, you know, 2-3 years at City, I knew I was getting opportunities playing with players like Ali Benabia, Al Berkovic. I was sleeping like a baby because I knew I would get opportunities, and that's what we have. And, you know, our forwards, they couldn't be in a better team. They just know there's opportunities there.
After leaving City, you had spells at Reading and Southend and then called it a day. What have you been doing since?
Well, I actually went back to Bermuda for 7 years, but since then got involved in a couple of businesses. But in the last 2 years, I've moved back here with a real interest and desire to improve my knowledge of the game, but to get involved from a coaching, get into coaching and management. And so I've been involved with doing a bit with Doncaster, helping out with the forwards there, Paul Dickoff. Really enjoy that. I've also do a bit of coaching a couple of days a week at Staley Bridge under 18s, involved with that, and every now and again I'm doing different media stuff, not only here but overseas. But the real sort of desire is to get on the pitch, coaching youngsters and eventually management.
Right. And are you doing badges or have you done them?
Yeah, I've just got the final assessment for the A license. So I've been doing that over the past few years whilst I was in Bermuda, coming back to to make sure I complete that.
It's difficult. There's a lot of work involved, I believe.
It is. You put on, you have to go back and do sort of like 20 sessions, do some theory to it, send in a video clips of your sessions. So it's quite detailed in what's expected of you. But I feel as you're right. It makes you, it assures that you're ready to have earned it.
Yeah.
That's similar to a driving lessons and driving tests. When someone passes, you know that they're capable of handling the road and handling a vehicle.
Five tests I did. Five driving tests. Eventually. Away from football, am I right in thinking you've never been a drinker? Is there any particular reason for that, or just?
Yeah, I mean, all the clubs I've been at, the lads always loved it because they thought, well, we've always got one designated lad who could make sure we get home safe, and the one person they didn't want to see the next day in training was me. I don't want to know what I've done.
Ah, yes.
But the culture's changed, and so I suppose now if you go into clubs and perhaps done a survey, you'd probably find there's probably half a dozen, you know, in a squad of 25, you know, three or four that's non-drinkers or choose to drink very little because the demands of the players and the game. But in my time of playing, it was only myself. But I remember even a period when Andy Morrison had stopped, I settled down and we had the Christmas dinner. And I thought, well, Andy's not drinking, and Andy's hanging about with me. And I go, Andy, you're making my night absolutely boring. Normally, I'm having a good laugh at everybody being pissed, but in the end, he done well. He stuck to his things. But yeah, I think today it's the norm that more and more players, you know, I wouldn't say they're not drinkers, but they don't drink as much. They probably have the glass of wine as opposed to get lathered in the years gone by.
Do you not find it really boring being sober in the company of people who aren't sober? Because they're just talking rubbish and shouting and repeating themselves. That's always been my experience.
Well, that I find that to be very humorous. I thought, I said, it'll be a good laugh this evening watching so-and-so. You know, when they get a bit lathered, but yeah, those days are certainly some days of the past. Yeah.
Do they still have Sean Goater Day in Bermuda? Is that an annual event or was it a one-off? I know they had one. Was it in June 2000? I think.
Well, you look forward to that day coming soon, June 21st. We were looking at doing some things here. So.
Okay.
But yeah, I was on it on June 21st. As Sean got a day, and it was brilliant. He had a motorcade, nice little motorcade. And you know, I was thinking myself, like when I was, it was actually on June 21st of 2000, and I was going back home to Bermuda, and I wanted to just ease into the country, but the government at the time wanted to make a big fuss and make some noise, and so they put on this big. Beat made his big deal about it, and I was on it with that, so very pleased.
It must have been surreal, was it?
Yes, because I'm a humble person. I'm thinking, okay, well, for me, you know, every day is Sean Goater Day. But we could put the stamp on there.
And like, what did your wife make of that? Is she just making fun of you, or quite honoured, or it just must be bizarre?
No, she's honoured. But inside is Mrs. Goater's Day. I'm the one doing all the cracking.
And you've been recognised by the Queen over here, and you've met her, got your MBE. It must have been a bit odd pitching up at Buckingham Palace, you know, having, say, arrived on the plane from when you were 18. Did you ever think you'd see the day?
Yeah, I mean, that story stems to similar story with me being in Bermuda. My house in Bermuda was on the boundary of the government house. And so when I was a kid, I used to always run through the woods to try to go into the grounds. And so years later, I was invited several times to the governor's house. So this is similar, you know, No, my house isn't on the boundary of the Queen's of Buckingham Palace, but to have the privilege, the honour of receiving the MBE for my services of giving back to football in Bermuda was special. So thoroughly enjoyed it.
And final question, I should have asked you earlier, but your mum was a good footballer. So is that where the genes came from?
Without doubt. She's huge. They had a ladies team. She used to work in a hotel in Bermuda years ago called Bermudiana, and they called the team Bermudiana Cosmos, obviously from the football team, the Cosmos. So she was huge in football. She always take me two games. I used to always go watch her play. So from there, that's really, it really came from the love of the game. And it's funny because when I used to go, when I was sort of like 9 and 10 and playing for my school team, and I'd play and score a couple of goals, say, "Oh, Mom, I scored like 4 goals." She's like, "You could have scored 7.
Right,
I was like, so steady.
She was your biggest critic.
Yes.
After Kevin Keegan.
Yeah.
Okay, Sean, well, thank you very much for your time. I've got to shake your hand now. I'm slightly concerned some of my fingers are going to break off because it's so cold.
Yes.
But, yeah, thanks a lot. It's been a really nice chat.